Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Steve Rendell, here with Peter Hart. This week on Counterspin, the Supreme Court hears the Hobby Lobby case, which is about women's health, reproductive rights, and claims of religious freedom. Jody Jacobson of RH Reality Check says it's all that and more. One more front in the rights battle against the Affordable Care Act. She'll join us to explain. Also on the show, 25 years after the Exxon Valdez oil spill in Alaska's Prince William Sound, and the sound is still not fully recovered. And spills are still in the news. The latest are in Galveston Bay and Lake Michigan. What does this say about the state of regulation? We'll talk to Huffington Post environmental reporter Kate Shepard. All that's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a look back at the week's press.
If you repeat something often enough, some people can start to believe it's true. Social Security is going bankrupt, for instance. Something like that seems to be happening with reporting on public workers' pensions. We're told over and over again that the retirement benefits promised to teachers, cops, and firefighters simply cannot be paid in full. A March 22nd piece in USA Today was typical. It leaned on politicians to make this case. Republican New Jersey Governor Chris Christie warned that his state could go the way of Detroit. New Jersey, readers learn, is $52 billion short. And it's hardly alone. Illinois is $187 billion in the hole. Since there's no one in the piece to question this narrative of crisis, it'd be hard to imagine any readers would draw any other conclusion. As the article puts it, states are facing ballooning retiree costs and budget-sucking liabilities. But there are plenty of people who say, hold on a minute. The article never puts those gargantuan numbers in any kind of context. $52 billion owed over how many years? As economist Dean Baker pointed out in a recent column, those amounts represent what is owed over 30 years. In the case of Illinois, that'd be $100 billion in an $18 trillion state economy. It's not nothing, but it helps put things in perspective. He and other analysts point out that pension fund projections made during the economic collapse look bad, but that the recovering stock market will improve the forecast in many states. Who knows whether that will do much to stem the flow of pension panic news reporting?
Venezuelan opposition leader Leopoldo Lopez's op-ed in the New York Times on March 26th was notable because he is currently in military prison there, but also for the correction that was quickly attached to it. Quote, an earlier version of this article incorrectly stated that the more than 30 killed in the political demonstrations in Venezuela since February 4th were protesters. That number includes security forces and civilians, not only protesters. Close quote. So the column now says that people on both sides have died. The original claimed all the dead were protesters. The impression that the violence comes from the government is a common one in U.S. and Venezuelan opposition media, which helps to explain why the Times initially printed the error. Much more reliable information can be found at the Center for Economic and Policy Research and Venezuela Analysis, where the deaths for at least the first month of the demonstrations have been carefully detailed. The group's findings largely agree, and as Venezuela Analysis concludes, each side has been directly responsible for about 9 deaths. Opposition barricades have also caused many of the deaths through accidents, delayed ambulances, and fights over their removal. There is a schism in the Venezuelan opposition between those who believe in defeating the Maduro government through democratic means and those, like op-ed writer Lopez, who favor force and street confrontations to remove the government. So it's not surprising that Lopez would conceal the fact that his side has been responsible for many of the deaths. The Times should have been on alert and caught the falsehood before publishing it.
Sometimes corporate media just come out and tell you what their priorities are. Take a March 26th Washington Post story, states use farm bill loophole to stem food stamp cuts. The Post makes clear what it sees as the important point here. The story's lead speaks of the loophole, quote, potentially wiping out billions of dollars in savings Congress agreed to last month, close quote. The last sentence of the piece notes that if states use this loophole, all $8.5 billion in cuts would disappear. Now, to the paper, this is bad news. Cutting food stamps was an important savings, and that is now in doubt. The loophole is a provision in food stamp law that gives slightly higher benefits to people who receive state subsidies for their heating bills. The law was formally written so that people who received as little as $1 in heating aid were eligible for what is known as heat and eat aid. And some states were giving just that much to some of their needy citizens to qualify them. The Republican-led House made it harder to get these supplementary food stamps. So the law was changed so that recipients had to receive at least $20 a year in heating aid to qualify. So governors in 8 states said they would comply with the law by raising their heating subsidies to that amount. This completely predictable response to a legislative change is what the Washington Post is describing as a loophole. It's a little like describing Oliver Twist as the story of a conniving orphan scheming to bust the poorhouse budget by demanding seconds of gruel.
National Review editor Rich Lowry hates military actions based on lies and force of arms, or so he told Meet the Press on March 23rd, where he denounced Vladimir Putin for his actions in Crimea. Quote, "He's living in a world where he can take territory through lies and force of arms," close quote. When you hear the words lies and force of arms, it's hard not to think of the U.S. invasion of Iraq, which Lowry didn't hate at all. Back then, when U.S. force of arms was the thing, Lowry was a famous purveyor of lies in support of the war, appearing on Face the Nation before the attack to claim that Iraq was in cahoots with al-Qaeda. No one cheered louder for mindless U.S. bloodletting back then than Rich Lowry, who explained shortly after the 9/11 terror attacks that, quote, "America, roused to a righteous anger, has always been a force for good. States that have been supporting, if not Osama bin Laden, people like him need to feel pain. If we flatten part of Damascus or Tehran or whatever it takes, that is part of the solution," close quote. And in a column a few weeks after the Iraq invasion, Lowry demanded accountability from the naysayers and those who were, in his view, wrong about the war. In reality, of course, those people were right, and the lies that Lowry promoted ended up costing hundreds of thousands of lives. But in the world of TV punditry, where apologies are unheard of and accountability non-existent, Lowry continues to treat viewers to his double standards and hypocrisy. Of course, if there was any accountability in corporate media, he'd be nowhere near a TV studio.
And finally, is everything that Iran does suspicious? It sure seems that way. Eric Schmidt of the New York Times got a tip from the U.S. government about what appeared to be an odd replica of a ship being built in plain sight in Iran. And he turned that tip into an alarmist article. He noted the U.S. view that the ship might be blown up for propaganda value. Schmidt gave one source anonymity to say Iran was aiming to demonstrate their resolve. But he was reaching for his own conclusions, too, writing that this ship was being built, quote, "presumably for some mysteriously bellicose purposes," close quote. And he even raised the idea that Iran could be trying to provoke the United States. He wasn't the only one sounding the alarm. USA Today had a piece titled, "Iranians Up to No Good with U.S. Aircraft Carrier Mock-Up," which relied on the analysis of a U.S. politician and 2 right-wing think tanks. But the Reuters Newswire offered a different take on March 23rd. "Iran says replica U.S. aircraft carrier is really a movie prop," was the headline, which might tell you all you need to know. The piece quotes an Iranian news site report that said this, quote, "Without any proof or real basis, Western media have jumped again to paint a more negative picture of Iran," close quote. Now, of course, there could be more to it than this, but absent any evidence, the U.S. media assumption was indeed that Iran was up to no good.
Thanks, Peter. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group, FAIR. FAIR also publishes a magazine called Extra. I'll be giving subscription information for Extra later on in the show.
The The Supreme Court heard oral arguments in the Hobby Lobby case on March 25th. The court devoted a longer than usual 90 minutes to the arguments, but that didn't necessarily add much clarity to the media coverage of this case. As you might know, the Christian-identified retailer is before the court arguing that providing certain contraceptives to its employees under the Affordable Care Act violates its religious beliefs. Beyond the "boy, this sure is divisive" soundbite battles, what are the fundamental issues at stake? We're joined now by Jody Jacobson. She's the editor-in-chief of the website RH Reality Check, which has been offering substantive coverage of the case for months now. Jody, welcome back to Counterspin.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, this is a case that touches on so many issues: corporate personhood, the still very unsettled state of the Affordable Care Act. The central question here is whether an employer can decide that certain forms of health care should not be available to employees who have insurance plans that would otherwise provide this care. So I guess the first thing to clear up might be this. Hobby Lobby is saying that certain forms of birth control are tantamount to abortion. That is the violation of their religious freedom. Is that true? Are these forms of birth control that they object to tantamount to abortion?
No. And there's two issues here. One is that the definition of pregnancy, medically speaking, is when a fertilized egg successfully implants into the uterus. And so one issue here is that you can't have an abortion if you're not pregnant. And the Hobby Lobby folks and the rest of the religious right are defining pregnancy on their own terms, which means the moment a fertilized egg is fertilized, or the moment an egg is fertilized. And there's no telling when that is. There's no test for that. There's no ability to zero in on that time, A. And B, 50% of all fertilized eggs are, in any case, sloughed off naturally. So there's that problem of the definition of pregnancy. The second is that the contraceptive methods we're talking about all have now been definitively shown to prevent fertilization in the first place. So even if you took their definition of pregnancy, which is not a definition of pregnancy recognized by the medical community, there's no abortion here. So this is all, I believe, part of a very broad effort. It's not just about Hobby Lobby, but a very broad effort that has lots of tentacles to eliminate access to contraception in this country because the far right is against contraception, period.
I'm under the impression that Hobby Lobby used to provide insurance that covered these.
Hobby Lobby provided contraceptive coverage in their plans until the Affordable Care Act. And they're not the only example of groups that are, in fact, suing the government to be exempt from the contraceptive benefit, who also had provided contraception in their coverage. And I want to make something clear because it's been made very confused. We are not talking about businesses or organizations providing contraception. We are talking about insurance coverage paid either by the employer as part of the overall compensation for an employee, or an employer-paid policy where the employee pays a share, or coverage offered where the employee pays the entire premium. So in any of these cases, this is an earned benefit, which includes, among many other things in preventive care, contraceptive coverage. So what the Hobby Lobby folks would like you to believe is they are being forced to, quote unquote, provide contraception. They're not.
Among the many things that are frustrating about reading coverage of this is that this scientific question is presented as a sort of contested area. And, you know, it's not just the media, it's the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. When one of the government lawyers points out that there is no law requiring a corporation to provide abortions, his response to that in the court was, "I thought that's what we had before us." Media refer to this as contested, whether this is tantamount to abortion. A piece you wrote last month pointed out that there still remains a place at the media table for people who are going to offer completely unscientific viewpoints on this.
Right. I mean, you know, public policy should be made on the basis of facts and evidence. Evidence does change. I mean, science evolves and things change. At one point in time, for example, it was not clear whether or not emergency contraception, as an example, could in fact prevent an already fertilized egg from implanting. The science now shows unequivocally that that's not possible and that it prevents ovulation in the first place. So in this whole sort of mix is something going back to another court case, which is Casey. And in that case, the justices opened up the door to allow contested science to be a sort of wedge in which people could also contest public policy. And the far right is using this in many arenas, climate change, contraceptive care, abortion care, to create a parallel universe of quote-unquote studies and science, and to then use those non-consensus pieces of work, many of them completely misleading and discredited, to say that there's contested scientific debate about these things, and then to use those to set policy by, again, claiming that there's contested science. And what I find really striking is that at the level of the Supreme Court, where one assumes that we have the best and the brightest on the Supreme Court, that at least, and I'm sorry to say in this case it is the men on the court, are apparently very, very far out of touch with what contraception and reproduction is all about and haven't done any homework in order to understand it. And so therefore are making judgment calls based on their own biases. So we have a real problem here because they may decide these cases based on an ideological agenda that has no basis in reality and therefore affect the lives of many millions of women who depend on affordable access to contraception.
Now, finally, the reaction to the oral arguments has been sort of resigned. There was a headline at Slate, Dahlia Lithwick's piece was, "Is the contraception mandate doomed? It sure looks that way." There is a reaction out there to this case, which is, okay, so maybe this kind of healthcare won't be covered. Nothing stopping you from going out and buying it yourself. Sort of a libertarian view. I don't want to malign all libertarians, but that's the sense of it. What's the problem with looking at this case and contraception that way, that you can just buy it yourself, so there really isn't a fundamental problem here?
So today I'm going to go to the pharmacy and I'm going to pick up 3 prescriptions I pay for every month. And even though they are covered and I only pay a copay, I will pay $120 for those prescriptions. They're not contraception in this case. They're just regular prescriptions I need to take regularly, probably for the rest of my life. I don't make minimum wage. I'm not a low-income or working poor person. I'm a person with relatively higher levels of resources, good health care coverage, et cetera. Put yourself in the place of a woman who might be facing $60 or $80 a month for contraception, let's say she's on the pill, or to get an IUD, $1,000 in doctor's visits and insertion and purchasing of an IUD, and who simply doesn't have that money, who may also have other prescription drugs she needs to buy, as well as perhaps prescription coverage for her kids. Making light of the affordability of contraceptive care is a deeply held strategy of the far right. The whole notion is one of saying, this is so irrelevant, it's not costly. It's a way of diminishing the reality that millions of women face. You don't hear them talking about, you know, the problems that we have covering Viagra. It's only when it comes to women's health care. And these are many of the same people, let's remember, who vociferously fought against the amendment to the Affordable Care Act that included coverage for pregnancy and childbirth. So it's really a distraction, but a distraction that is dangerous for individual women.
We've been speaking with Jody Jacobson. She's the editor-in-chief of RH Reality Check. You can find them at rhrealitycheck.org. Thanks for joining us this week on Counterspin, Jody Jacobson.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's been 25 years since the Exxon Valdez spilled at least 10 million gallons of oil into Prince William Sound, contaminating 1,300 miles of Alaskan coastal waters and shoreline. A year after the spill, regulatory safeguards were put into place to diminish the incidence and severity of new spills. But the oil keeps spilling and damaging environments. 2010 saw the gigantic BP Deepwater Horizon spill in the Gulf of Mexico, and just this month there have been smaller spills off Galveston, Texas, and Lake Michigan. We're joined now by Kate Shepard, an environmental reporter for the Huffington Post, where you can read her report, 25 years after Exxon Valdez spill, environmental advocates say oil laws outdated. Welcome back to Counterspin, Kate Shepard.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, tell us about Prince William Sound. Back to normal?
No, not back to normal from what scientists and the oil spill trustees up there have said. You still can find oil on the beach. They say it may take, 100 years for all the oil to go away, and that the oil that's still there is just as toxic as it was 25 years ago.
And some of the species have come back, but others haven't, right?
No, others haven't. Several that have been noted as not having recovered are killer whale and herring species up there, but there are broader ecosystem-wide impacts of the oil that are ongoing and people say are probably never going to be the same again.
Well, I saw that USA Today, in its 25th anniversary coverage, said that quoted somebody saying that the cleanup had been relatively successful. Was the reality reflected in the 25th anniversary coverage as far as what you've seen?
It's really a good question is, what does relatively successful even mean? It's probably better than it could have been, that they have done as much work as one might hope, but the reality is it's just really extremely difficult to remove oil from an ecosystem, and once it happens, it's not really that simple to put it back in place. So I think that the decent amount of coverage reflecting the fact that it hasn't been fully restored. But I actually didn't see all that much coverage of it in general. Even as an environmental reporter who was on the lookout for those sort of things, I didn't feel like it got that much attention in the news media this week at all. Exxon anniversary provides an opportunity to reflect upon the kinds of regulations we have in place in terms of oil spill response. Even if oil companies are expected to have a response plan on the books that they have to use in case of an accident, one of the things environmental advocates have pointed out is that you don't necessarily have to have demonstrated that you can actually execute that response. And that's what we saw with the BP oil spill that I think was so shocking to so many people, is that all of us assume that if we know how to drill a mile under the ocean, we know how to stop a leak when it happens. And that really showed us that we couldn't. We had no idea. And that's why it went on for so many weeks. So I think that the Exxon anniversary is another opportunity to reflect upon that reality, is that our ability to drill, the technology that you need to drill, has gotten much more advanced, but our response plans haven't really gotten much more advanced at all.
Well, let's talk about the safeguards. Regulations were put in place in 1990, a year after the Exxon Valdez spill, that were made a pretty big deal of at the time. How have they held up?
I think that the Oil Pollution Act, which passed in 1990 after the spill, was really good in a lot of ways. A number of environmental advocates will say that as well. It did good things like create the Oil Spill Liability Trust Fund to help pay for response to a spill. It put a per barrel of oil fee that would go into that fund to help pay for those costs. It set new liability limits. It made the responsible parties more, it put more pressure on them to respond in the event of an accident. So those things were really good, but I think the bigger issue that we're reflecting on now is the fact that those rules haven't been updated in 25 years. So the dollar figures that were included in those rules haven't been updated for the cost of inflation at all. And, looking around, everything else here in the U.S. costs a whole lot more than it did 25 years ago, but that dollars are exactly the same as they were in 1990.
Is it true that some kinds of oil spills also don't fall under that act?
Yes. So right now, based on the current way it's worded in the tax code, oil that is oil from the tar sands of Canada is not included under the definition of conventional crude. There's currently an effort underway in the Senate that would classify it as something that would fall under the kind of oil that has to pay into the fund, but right now it doesn't have to.
Well, tar sands from Canada, that's what is going to be pushed through the, if it goes through, the Keystone XL pipeline, right?
Right, exactly. It's what would go through Keystone XL. It's what went through the pipeline that spilled in Kalamazoo, Michigan 4 years ago. It's what went through the pipeline that spilled in Mayflower, Arkansas last year. So we're seeing increased pipeline transportation of fuel from Canada's oil sands, but at the same time, it's not included in in that particular portion of legislation.
Well, you said you've seen relatively little coverage of the 25th anniversary of Exxon Valdez. I've seen it actually mentioned in several articles about the Galveston Bay spill that's that's being cleaned up as we speak, but by papers that didn't do an actual piece on the 25th anniversary. Now,
right, it's sort of this kind of sick coincidence that we had this Galveston Bay spill right ahead of the Exxon anniversary. It sort of gave more significance to the Exxon anniversary in a lot of ways, and I think you're right that that was reflected in some of the coverage.
Well, you say that that was perhaps undercovered. What about coverage of the need for a new regulatory regime? I mean, a lot of groups that – a lot of not-for-profits, NGOs that look at these things think that there should be a new regulatory regime, right?
Right. I mean, I think a lot of them do think that and have advocated for that. But if you just think back, you know, not that long ago to the BP spill, that was the biggest oil spill in U.S. history. And there was a push to reform regulations right after that spill, but it never went anywhere. It passed in the House, never passed in the Senate. So if you couldn't reform those regulations in the immediate aftermath of a spill that was that huge and had that much of a significance for people in the U.S., I think it's really hard to see what it would take to actually push through meaningful reforms.
You quote someone in your piece on how, in order to make real change in the regulations, we'd need a different Congress. Do we need a different media approach, too, do you think, journalists?
I mean, probably. I mean, we tend in the media to cover things only when there is a disaster. So we covered lots about oil spills when the BP spill is happening. When a pipeline breaks, we cover it immediately. But there's not a whole lot of long-term coverage of the broader issues. I think it's sort of true in a lot of media that we focus on crises and not on long-term solutions. So I think that's one thing that we could all do better.
We've been speaking with Kate Shepard, environmental reporter for Huffington Post, where you can read her piece on the anniversary of the Exxon Valdez disaster and the need for new laws to regulate drilling and transporting of oil. Thanks again for joining us on Counterspin today, Kate Shepard.
Thanks for having me.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the Media Watch Group, Fair. Fair also publishes a monthly magazine called Extra, which you can subscribe to at the Fair website at fair.org, which is also where you can listen to Counterspin or subscribe to the Counterspin podcast or sign up for Fair's Action Alert Network. This show was engineered by Alex Noyes, co-hosted by Peter Hart. I'm Steve Rendell. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.